All right, thank you. You can be seated. All right, Mr. Bastris, whenever you're ready.
May it please the court, my name is Robert Bastris. I'm here to represent the appellants in this case, Brian Green, Jordan Green, Todd Meister, and Bradley Smith. Together they challenge North Carolina General Statute 163-122 subsection A, which prescribes the procedures for unaffiliated candidates to obtain access to the general election ballot in North Carolina. Specifically, plaintiffs challenge the provision in subsection A, two of that section that requires unaffiliated candidates for the House of Representatives to submit petitions with at least 4% of the vote of the registered voters within their districts. Appellants mount that challenge on both First and 14th Amendment grounds, including due process clause incorporating the First Amendment and the Equal Protection Clause.
How do you distinguish your case from the Jennings case?
Well, there are several distinctions we would make, Your Honor. And, of course, the Jennings case was a major part of the district court's decision denying plaintiff's motion for summary judgment. First of all, I would note that Jennings was only the second ballot access case the U.S. Supreme Court ever decided. It was right after Williams versus Rhodes. And it was 13 years before Anderson versus Celebrezze, and 20 years before the equally important cases in Burdick versus Takushi and Norman versus Reed. And those cases.
Are you saying that Genesis is no longer a good law?
No, I'm not saying that. I'm saying that it's the court has in those cases, Anderson versus Celebrezze and Takushi, have created an analysis which is more demanding of the courts in examining severe burdens on access to the ballot, and that that kind of analysis simply was not in place at the time that Jennings was decided.
Decide Jennings, though, don't they?
I'm sorry.
Doesn't the Supreme Court continue to cite Jennings?
Yes, yes. And there's certainly pieces of Jennings that is clearly good law. The most recent cite to it, for example, was in the case out of New York, dealing in which the court cited it for the point that the state is entitled to insist on a certain modicum of support before it has to put candidates on the ballot. And that's clear. I mean, that's always been the law and clearly remains the law. I think what we would say about Jennings is that it's really the most significant factor is I think it's factually distinguishable. Jennings said in that case that Georgia had not frozen the status quo in allowing candidates on the ballot. And we would submit that North Carolina has frozen the status quo for 110 years in terms of access for House of Representative candidates, unaffiliated candidates to get to the ballot. There has not been one in the 110-year period since the state went to the Australian ballot. And that's, I would say that's freezing the status quo. It's virtually putting it in a glacier and encasing it. So what we're saying is that while Jennings versus Fortson is still good law, the specific finding in that case that a particular line in the sand, that a particular line on the continuum of the number of signatures a state may require is subject to reexamination in a different context. And we have that different context in this case. I don't think there's any dispute that the First Amendment analysis that applies here is the Anderson versus Celebrezze analysis. which looks at the character and magnitude, what's the degree of the burden on the First Amendment interest, and then balances that against the precise interest that the state puts forward, the legitimacy and strength of those interests, and taking into account the degree to which they're necessary. And then I mentioned the verdict in Norman versus Reed cases, which came along about 10 years later, and create a put a certain gloss on that, and effectively create what I would call, characterize as a sliding scale. And this analysis was accepted by this court in McLaughlin versus North Carolina Board of Elections back in 1990s.
And what determine, what are the parameters of the scale? How do we determine if that's correct?
Yes. I think there's general consensus that if the burden that it places on the exercise, on the access to the ballot, is severe, then you have to apply the compelling state interest analysis.
And that's one end.
Right, right. And I think there's a middle ground, that if it's a moderate burden, then the state has to have more than just a rational basis. It's got to have an interest of some import.
And what case has said that?
McLaughlin did.
McLaughlin?
Yeah.
I thought it found, McLaughlin found that there was, that it was a severe burden.
There were several issues in McLaughlin, and the principal one was whether the state's imposition of a 10% vote attainment in, once a new party is on the ballot, they have to get 10% to stay on the ballot. And that's what was, that was the principal challenge in McLaughlin. There were some other minor issues. In one case, the court did find a violation of the Libertarian Party's rights. But that, I think the case, the analysis in McLaughlin is true to what the court did in Burdick and Norman versus Reed. And then, of course, you have the lower end of the spectrum, where if it's a light burden, then the normal state interest in administering its election laws will be accepted. And the district court in this case agreed with the plaintiffs and appellants that, and I should back up too, the courts have also agreed that in determining the burden, the degree of the burden imposed, whether it's severe or not, the best evidence is really how is it operated in fact. And the Storer versus Brown analysis looks at what has been the experience under the challenge provision and asks the question, could a reasonably diligent candidate be expected to satisfy this requirement, or will it be only rarely that the unaffiliated candidate can succeed? And so you look for the record to see which is the case and which is not. And the district court agreed with the plaintiffs that this was a case of a severe burden. And it was virtually an unescapable conclusion.
The district court said that, but then immediately after that, its analysis collapsed into something far less than a severe burden.
Well, I would say it found a severe burden, but then did not apply compelling state interest analysis. I think that's how I would characterize what the district court did.
Cited to Anderson versus Celebrezzi. How does that case help you?
How does Anderson help us? Well, I think Anderson sets out the framework, and it helps us because it basically says if you look to the character and degree of the burden, and then you look to the nature of the state interests, and we're looking at a state law which has created a severe burden. And then, of course, those later cases make clear that if it's a severe burden, you got to apply strict scrutiny.
Well, suppose we don't accept the district court's finding that it was a severe burden. Where does that leave you?
Well, I can't imagine how you can't find a severe burden, since there wasn't one candidate to qualify under this provision in 110 years.
People tried.
Yes, people have tried. We tried to get that evidence.
Wait.
I'm sorry.
You can answer my question if I can't answer.
Okay.
How do you know how many people tried to get on the ballot? I mean, maybe nobody tried.
Well, the state was able to adduce some evidence of people that had made the effort. The problem is that the state ordinarily doesn't keep records of people who try and fail. Sorry, I'm hitting the mic here. the many other states, for example, require if you want to go out and collect signatures, you got to at least file a candidacy certificacy, certificate of candidacy, and then that state will have records. But North Carolina does not do that. If an unaffiliated candidate wants to run for Congress, he just goes out and starts collecting signatures on a petition. And if he's, you know, if he doesn't get to the magic number, it could well be that those petitions would signatures would never get submitted, and there would be no record of that. And so we ask in Executive Director Bartlett's deposition whether those records existed, and he said no. We did eventually get some responses on that, but there's nothing to indicate how frequent people have attempted to achieve unaffiliated ballot access. And going back to the district courts, a couple of things about the district court's analysis. Once it finds this severe burden, it then points to the fact that a recent candidate did in fact collect a sufficient number of signatures to qualify. He eventually decided not to run. That candidacy was in the 8th District, as I recall, a guy named Font, who did succeed in collecting the signatures. That occurred after the discovery closed in this case, however, and we were not able to gather evidence on that. We just know that he had enough signatures, and there were media reports that he was heavily supported by some big money. But I don't think that, and the court could decide a remand is appropriate to explore that, but I don't think that's necessary, because that one instance of success is barely even relevant to this case. I couldn't say it's irrelevant, but it barely dents the finding that this statute imposes a severe burden. And I say that by going back to Storer versus Brown. Can a reasonably diligent candidate be expected to get on the ballot? It doesn't say, can a candidate with heroic efforts get on the ballot? It says reasonably diligent, and that had not occurred in 110 years.
Well, doesn't the candidate for a congressional seat have a year and a half to gather the signatures?
There are not strict time limitations imposed on the on congressional candidates. That's true.
A year and a half, that's a long time.
Yeah, but
seems to me like if you couldn't make a reasonable effort within a year and a half, you couldn't make one at all.
Well, the problem is in petitioning that when you're far removed from the election, it's difficult to get people's attention. It's difficult to get them to sign on to petitions. Petitioning only gets effective, typically, as you move closer towards the election. And indeed, the candidate in this, the intervener in this case, Bradley Smith, had been collecting signatures for 8 months. And of course, he did have a fair amount of success in collecting signatures. He collected enough signatures that would have gotten him on the ballot in all but a handful of states in this country. He turned in over 10,000 signatures, at least 7,500 of which or so were valid, and that would have greased his access to the ballot just about everywhere in the United States except this handful of states.
Do you question the state's right to require a certain percentage of voters to sign a petition?
No, I don't.
And where would you draw the line? What do you believe would be constitutional?
Well, I mean, I think that's where the district court backed off. It said that, in effect, courts can't draw these lines in precise ways, citing the McLaughlin case. Where would I draw the line? It would be way short of where most states, where the North Carolina draws it. I'm from West Virginia, and our line is at 1%, which is still one of the highest in the country. The median, I think, is 2,000 some signatures, and most states are well below 1% in terms of what they require. A lot of states just require 1,000 signatures or something like that. So I think that the experience in other states has shown us that these 2-4% requirements aren't really necessary to achieve the state's interest in ensuring seriousness of candidates and maintaining a reasonable ballot. Other states simply have not had the problem.
The reason I'm asking is that you're having the same difficulty I think courts would have trying to figure out what percentage of signatures indicates more than a modicum of support.
Yeah, I'll tell you. And I said this is where the district court backed off, making the statement that courts can't draw these lines. But in the election law area, courts do draw lines. They review just where on a continuum a line is being drawn, and they've been doing that since Williams versus Rhode and Jennings versus Fortson. Williams versus Rhode, 15 is too much. 5% is okay. I mean, I think our experience has shown it's not, but nevertheless, that's what the court was doing.
Are you saying that's part of the calculus then under the Anderson test of determining the degree of burden that is necessarily done comparatively with respect to others?
Yes, yes. And what courts have to do in election law cases is decide when the state has gone too far on these continuums. A case shortly after Jennings versus Fortson was Dunn versus Blumstein, where the court said a one-year durational residency requirement for voting is unconstitutional. The following year in Marston versus Lewis, it said, well, a 50-day closing period prior for registration prior to the election is okay, drawing a line again. Rosario versus Rockefeller said that 8 to 11 months for disenfranchisement for people who switch parties is okay. It affected the legitimate state's interest, but then a couple years later it decides Cusper versus Pontikis, and it said 22 months is way too much. So again, there are all kinds of these cases in election law where courts have to make the judgment about what is too much. And it's a judgment about when the state has exceeded its legitimate interests. And so in this case, the state has identified as the interest in having petitioning to get on the ballot that it needs to control, manage the ballot, needs to ensure serious candidates and prevent frivolous ones. And so it's imposed these requirements.
Let me go back to a question, Judge.
Sure.
And ask you the Jennings case. In all of the Supreme Court cases after that, I didn't see any attempt by the Supreme Court to disavow the acceptance of the 5% requirement as a constitutional limitation.
It has not done that.
So,
but it hasn't really had that issue before it since Jennings. But it has had before it. What should be the appropriate analysis in ballot access cases?
But it's had opportunities to revisit Genesis, if it wanted to, and I've never seen them disavow that.
Right.
Which makes me nervous starting to say, well, I know the Supreme Court said 5, but we're going to say less than that.
Well, it's what I said earlier. This is a different context. You're not faced with a situation in which the state has not frozen the status quo. North Carolina has. And I think you could decide this case by finding this a severe burden perfectly consistent with Jennings versus Fortson. You just have a different factual record. And we don't know, the case did not elaborate that much on why it made the conclusion that the status quo wasn't frozen, but that clearly does not describe North Carolina's law. And so, continuing to the point I was making, In drawing a line, you have to look at when the state's interest is adequately met. And in this case, the state has itself said that 2% is sufficient in statewide elections and in races for Senate. And that's a pretty good indication of when the state has adequately satisfied its interest. And anything beyond that, it seems to me, is overkill. It's not narrowly tailored to achieve the state's interest, and that's almost proven by the fact there's never been an independent candidate on the ballot for House of Representatives.
In the areas where 2% is okay, are those for larger geographical areas or smaller geographical areas, or are they both?
No, I'm out of time, but
well,
I'll answer
you
your
can
question.
Answer that question.
I think the geographical distinctions,
maybe not geographical, voter size, I should say.
Yeah, do not make sense. And let me elaborate a little bit. It's all relative. The bigger your geographical area, you just have to expend more resources. The smaller you can concentrate, but you still have to get a certain percentage of the vote. In addition, to the extent that the state imposes only a 2% requirement for statewide candidates and 4 for congressional candidates, it actually can be perverse because a lot of the North Carolina lies in rural areas, including the two districts that my clients work in. And it's very difficult to canvass in rural areas because there are no concentrations of people. Statewide petitions can concentrate in urban areas and have a much easier time collecting signatures than the people in the 5th and 10th districts of North Carolina.
Okay.
And it works backwards.
Okay.
Appreciate it, Your Honor. Thank you.
Let's hear from North Carolina.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the Court. I'm Alexander Peters of the North Carolina Attorney General's Office, and with me is Susan Nichols, also of that office. If I may, I'd like to pick up on the last question you asked, Judge Traxler, because I think it gets right to a fundamental problem that we see in the argument that the plaintiff has put forth. You asked whether the 2% requirement applies to smaller geographical regions or larger.
But I mean voter population.
Right, right. The 2% requirement is a statewide requirement. So when we're talking the 2% requirement, we're talking in excess of 6 million registered voters in North Carolina. A fundamental problem that we see as we read through the plaintiff's brief and as we've listened to the argument today is the plaintiffs keep talking about 163-122A being a statute that sets the requirements for candidates for the United States House of Representatives. And that is not exactly accurate. What 163-122A does is set the requirements for anyone in North Carolina who wants to run as an unaffiliated candidate. 122-A1 deals with people who want to run statewide as an unaffiliated candidate. So it's not just the Senate races that the plaintiffs keep referring to. It's also governor. It's also lieutenant governor. It's also the eight other members of the North Carolina Council of State. As we've referenced elsewhere in our brief, North Carolina elects more statewide officers than all but three other states in the country. 163-122A2, 3, and 4 deal with any candidate who wants to run on a district level as an unaffiliated candidate, whether that district is United States House of Representatives, North Carolina House of Representatives, North Carolina Senate, City Council, School Board, Water and Soil districts that we have way too many of in North Carolina. Whether it's any of those things, they apply to district races. And the only distinctions between A2, A3, and A4 is in A2, deals with districts that encompass portions of more than one county and therefore fall to the State Board of Elections to oversee that election, while A3 and A4 deal with municipal elections and elections for districts that are wholly within a county. This is important in a number of ways. Primarily, it's important because it shows the falsity of the claims made by plaintiffs that no one has ever complied with the provision. In the record, at pages 179 through 184 of the Joint Appendix, there's a list of, I believe, 95 people who have complied with this requirement in the last 20 years. And the reason it's the last 20 years is because those are the years we have records for. So the reality is this statute that they have challenged, while they say nobody has ever been able to meet this statute, the fact is at least 95 people have met the requirements of this statute. Now, it is true that only one of them was someone seeking to become a candidate for the United States House of Representatives. All the others are for other offices, but it does include the North Carolina legislature. Districts in the North Carolina legislature. And as Judge Mullen noted, there was someone just last year who satisfied the requirement for the United States House of Representatives. And contrary to what the plaintiffs have said, they say that's not in the record and it came up later. It is in the record. It's in the state's answer to the intervener plaintiff's complaint, because when he alleged that no one had ever met the requirement, we denied that and listed that example of someone who had met the requirement. So what we're actually dealing with is a statute that almost 100 people we know of in the last 20 years have been able to comply with. That's a very different situation from the way the plaintiffs would like to present it. It also, the fundamental flaw here in looking at these statutes and in taking them out of their context of what they actually do address, all district races in North Carolina. The plaintiffs are making a second fundamental error, and that is failing to do what this court said in McLaughlin and what this court said in Wood is necessary, and that is to look at the access requirement in the context of the full election scheme, in the context of how the entire system works. It's not unlike the example given in the previous argument of you don't just look at the nose, you look at the entire face and see how it all fits together. There's no doubt that there is a spectrum. The plaintiffs seem to suggest the same thing, that there is a spectrum of allowable variations among the states. If that were not the case, then all states would have a single requirement. There's no question that there is a spectrum in there that's allowable. And the question for the courts becomes, and there are always going to be outliers on that spectrum. Doesn't matter where you draw the line, there's going to be somebody who's at the upper end of it, which in this case is not North Carolina. And there's going to be somebody who's at the lower end of it. And the question for the courts becomes, when do those outliers, particularly at the top, when do those outliers go so far away from the spectrum? When do they go so far that they are no longer constitutional? The district court acknowledged that very thing in its order at pages 9 and 10, where it said, while on the high end of the petitioning requirement spectrum, North Carolina's 4% requirement passes strict scrutiny because it is the only aspect of North Carolina's election requirements that presents a barrier of any significance to an unaffiliated candidate.
Do you agree that strict scrutiny is the appropriate standard for us to evaluate this restriction?
We did argue, Your Honor, to the district court that strict scrutiny was not applicable, but we did not appeal that decision of the district court holding that strict scrutiny was the appropriate standard to apply. We do believe that even if that is the appropriate standard to apply, it is met here.
So you're also not appealing the characterization of the restriction as severe?
No, Your Honor, we did not. And it's in this context of looking at the spectrum and the way everything fits together that I think the district court properly looked at the Janus case. Because as this court has noted this morning, that's a case where it was a 5% requirement and the United States Supreme Court said that was all right. That did not exceed constitutional bounds. But what's striking about it is that the framework in Georgia, the larger framework, the complex whole that the state, that the court looked at is not that different from North Carolina's. To the degree it is different, it could be said to be more restrictive. Because in Georgia, you had 180 days to collect 5%. In North Carolina, as has been noted, you have a year and a half to collect 4%. Like Georgia, North Carolina has very lenient provisions with regard to write-in candidates if someone wishes to pursue that avenue. Like Georgia, North Carolina does not restrict how many petitions a person can sign. A registered voter can sign 20 different petitions if he or she wants to. Like Georgia, signing the petition is not in any way binding the signatory to vote for that candidate. Someone can sign a petition even if they have voted in a primary. All of those things are there. The only distinction that the plaintiff has been able to point to is the distinction of the history and noting that no one has been able to comply with this requirement. But as we say, almost 100 people have complied with this requirement.
Well, not in running for Congress.
Not in running for Congress, Your Honor, except for the one, excuse me, for the one that we know of. But I think that raises the question that Judge Traxler asked earlier. Why have people not qualified for Congress? There is no evidence in the record that anyone other than the plaintiffs in this case have tried and been unable to meet the requirement. Is it because the amount of signatures required? Is it because nobody has been interested in doing that? Is it for any number of reasons? We don't know. The record is silent as to that, and that's the plaintiff's burden, is to come forward with that evidence. It is not the state's burden to show why people have not qualified for Congress. It's the plaintiff's burden to show that this is the reason. Otherwise, we have a basic logical fallacy here. The requirement is high. People haven't qualified. This is the reason people haven't qualified. And that's just speculation at best.
What justification is there for requiring only a 2% signature requirement for some elections with 4 in this particular case? Or is that relevant?
Well, I don't know that it is relevant, Your Honor, because it is not similarly situated entities or candidates in the case. But the 2% in this case requires to statewide. And I believe the justification is that is both it is more difficult to run a statewide petitioning campaign. And there's also the reality in this case, in North Carolina, that is still always going to produce a higher number than the district races at 4%. As the record in this case shows, the biggest district that could be at play, where one could be seeking signatures in North Carolina, prior to the current redistricting, the biggest district was North Carolina's 4th Congressional District. And in that district, a little bit over 20,000 signatures would be required to meet the 4% standard.
He argues that on a statewide race, it's easier to get signatures because then you can go to the big cities where the population is compact, and it's easier to get them. With regard to his congressional districts, they're spread out, people are spread out, and it's actually harder.
I would suggest, Your Honor, that's not always the case, because the 2% requirement also requires that the signatures come from multiple congressional districts. They can't all be gathered in one place, at least not, and still meet the other requirement that the signatures have to come from multiple congressional districts.
And the reason I'm asking this is, the question is whether or not it's narrowly tailored. You've got different requirements for different areas, and there's got to be some logical reason for the differences.
Your Honor, I think, as I say, the reason is the difference in a campaign or a petitioning drive, if you will, that is statewide as opposed to one that is confined to a district. And it's also the reality that, because unlike in the Illinois Board of Elections case, the Socialist Workers case, where the courts were comparing a flat 25,000 signature with a percentage, which resulted in a district in Chicago requiring a much higher percentage than the 25,000 required statewide. Here, the 2% statewide is always going to be significantly higher than the 4% on a district. Again, the most we would have in a district as of before our districts were just redrawn was in the low 20,000s, whereas statewide it's closer to 70,000 that would be required to meet it. So it is quite a difference there. I think, Your Honors, the bottom line here really is the district court was correct to look at the Janus case and say, the Supreme Court has looked at a provision that, if anything, is more restrictive than North Carolina's. It's at 5% rather than 4%. It doesn't allow as much time to gather the signatures as North Carolina does. And the Supreme Court said that's okay, that that is not outside the bounds of constitutional propriety. And if that's the case, it's just very difficult, to imagine how North Carolina's can be unconstitutional if Georgia's is not. Georgia is similar to North Carolina in another fashion. I would point out, as I mentioned earlier, part of the complex whole that we deal with here is North Carolina has longer ballots than lots of states do because we elect so many statewide officers. And unlike, say, Virginia, where the state races, the gubernatorial races, are not in the same year as presidential races, we do all of those things in the same year as presidential races. We elect the governor, we elect the lieutenant governor, the council of state, the legislature, all of those in the same years as the presidential race. Has been pointed out, there are two states with higher requirements than North Carolina. Those two states are Georgia, the same state that was at issue in Janus that has the 5% requirement, and Arizona, which, as the plaintiffs have pointed out, has a 3% requirement in Arizona. That's part of what we have to deal with in North Carolina. We constitutionally have a long ballot. And that is part of what the state has to take into account when it is considering the ballot access requirements, because anything that adds to that ballot can be significant. As the executive director of the State Board of Elections pointed out in his deposition, there are two types of voting equipment used in North Carolina, one of which is the optical scan machines. So when the ballots start getting long, it can create a real problem on election day, and it can create a real problem with counting the votes. That's part of the reality we deal with here. It appears to be part of the reality Georgia deals with. The Supreme Court said Georgia's scheme passes constitutional muster, and we believe that Judge Mullen correctly noted there's no difference here with ours.
Okay. With regard to the equal protection claim, are you agreeing or not contesting an application of a strict scrutiny? I mean, everybody's talking about strict scrutiny in the context of the First Amendment claim, but I haven't heard a discussion of the equal protection standard.
Well, Your Honor, we would say in the equal protection claim that we don't get there because, as Judge Mullen pointed out, and we agree with him, we're not comparing similarly situated people.
Okay.
And because we're not comparing similarly situated people, we don't get to the question of what level of scrutiny should apply.
What standard do you think the court applied in Genesis?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
What standard do you think the court applied in Genesis?
It would appear to me that the court in Genesis applied, I'm not sure they're specific about it, they applied something that might be in the realm of a strict scrutiny to closely drawn standards, somewhere in there, what we would call that now. But regardless, again, I think Judge Mullen is correct that even if a strict scrutiny standard is applied, this statute passes muster. Whatever standard the Supreme Court did apply in Genesis before all the other cases that came after it, it said the statute was okay. And it has cited Genesis time and time again. It has never overruled it. It has never questioned it. It has never backed away from it. So we would submit it controls, unless the court has other questions.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Reply.
A couple points. The state is correct that we have focused this litigation on its impact on candidates for the House of Representatives, and that's what we're saying, that this statute as applied to candidates for the House of Representatives creates a severe burden. And furthermore, we are challenging on equal protection grounds the differential treatment of candidates for one House of Congress from candidates for another House of Congress. I mean, there's absolutely no precedent on this, but mainly because I think North Carolina is probably the only one who requires more of House of Representatives unaffiliated candidates than it does of senatorial candidates. It makes absolutely no sense to treat candidates for Congress differently because of which House they're seeking. And the state has produced no explanation for why there is differential treatment.
It's based on the size of the voting population. Senators running statewide, Congressman's running for a particular district.
Well, that's a difference, but it's not a difference with a distinction, I don't think. I mean, the state says we're not similarly situated, but I don't know how you can say that people running for Congress are not similarly situated. They're embroiled in an effort to try to join the national legislature, and it seems to me they ought to be facing the precise same obstacles facing the same obstacles.
Well, let me tell you what's troubling about that to me. You argue the point or the fact that no affiliated candidates other than supposed Mr. Pham have run for Congress from North Carolina. But the record doesn't indicate why that's so. Is it because few, if any, have tried? Is it because those who have tried had held views that prevented them from governing a modicum of support? Or is it because those who may have tried to put forward no more effort than did Mr. Green in this case?
Well, I can
the record see, is silent on all that.
I concede the record is. We tried to get that evidence, and we couldn't because there are no records. And I think one could also infer that when you have such a considerable obstacle to get there, it discourages people from running. And I might add, too, so does that filing fee. And that's one of our points. It's not that the filing fee is not necessarily an obstacle to ballot access, but it certainly discourages people from running. And it's also the whole purpose of a filing fee is to ensure seriousness of candidacy, and that's on top of this 4% requirement. And I think it's another indication that this law is not narrowly tailored.
Yeah, it may be in the record, but I don't recall it. Do you recall the population of the district in which Mr. Fant circulated his petition and got the 35,425?
His district required him to come up with right around 20,000 signatures.
What was the population of that district?
Oh, the population. Well, I don't know for sure. I assume it was the same as most congressional districts in North Carolina, which would be in the 650,000-700,000 range by the end of the 10 years. But I would like to make one last point, if I might. The state's business about it's got a long ballot. You know, the state makes a choice about what it wants to designate as an elective office. And that's obviously within its democratic rights. But it cannot say we're going to elect all these positions and then draw obstacles around who can seek them. I mean, it is a democracy, and just because it has a long ballot doesn't mean you have fewer rights to seek election in North Carolina. Thank you, Your Honors. I appreciate the opportunity.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Bashers. We'll come down and greet counsel and then go into the next case.